It, I probably take her. Da Vinci. You really like Jordan Peterson?
I love Jordan Peterson.
He's a Jungian psychologist. He's got this weird thing about lobsters. What on earth do you like about Jordan Peterson?
No. Jordan Peterson is awesome. What I love about him is that his main contention, if you will, is that you have to speak. You can't be afraid to speak because there are consequences to speaking, but truth is the cornerstone of society, and society cannot be upheld without truth, and people need to speak what they believe no matter how dumb they feel doing it.
Well, honestly, maybe I need to watch some of his videos. I loved his video from 6 months, maybe a year back, where he was saying things, but he was being interviewed by a reporter from London, and it got quite a bit of buzz in my circles of friends, at least, because people kept reposting it on Facebook, where he would say something basically pretty factual and normal, something to the effect of, like, yes, men are, in fact, different than women, and the reporter would rephrase it like, so what you're really saying is that men hate women.
Oh, no. I bet he didn't react well to that at all.
He did not. He really just kind of,
He lost it.
Sort of ripped her head off in a very polite, effective way. And no, I've just not listened to enough of his stuff, but I know he's really popular.
Yeah, his whole thing is about taking responsibility, and humans are built to take responsibility for something, and that kind of aids in giving you purpose. And it's a fulfilling thing to have responsibility over something, or else you're just doing nothing. And I mean, what's the point of that?
Well, that's certainly a helpful message, and maybe one that we don't hear enough about today. Well, we're not here to talk about Jordan Peterson this whole episode. Instead, today we're going to be dealing with houses. Well, you groan, but as a homeowner, I'm kind of excited about today's episode. This is going to be a lot of fun. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to What's the Res, an ongoing conversation about the current resolutions in the world of high school debate. My name is Josh Herring. I'm a debate coach and humanities instructor at Thales Academy in Rollsville, North Carolina. And today I'm joined by Ethan Delves. Ethan, what should our audience know about you?
Our audience should know that I absolutely love debate with a passion. I think that debate is what teaches you how to speak with people and how to articulate your ideas properly so that you can get them out there, bounce them off of other people, and see what they think. And as Jordan Peterson would argue, I think speaking and truth is a cornerstone of society, and people should learn how to do it. It's important.
Excellent. And of course, we couldn't do these episodes without our sound engineer, Noah Berman, who is currently running everything behind the scenes on this episode. So thank you, Noah. Today we're here to do an episode going over kind of resolution analysis for the March Public Forum resolution. Ethan, read us the resolution.
The resolution for this tournament, or the public forum resolution for the Dogwood tournament, is going to be: the United States should promote the development of market rate housing in urban neighborhoods.
There's a lot going on here. What leaps out at you about this resolution?
So the first thing that leaps out is that there's no actor. It just says the United States should, which, I mean, you can consider the United States an actor, but it's not naming anything federal. It's not naming local or state. And then promote was one thing that kind of leapt out at me, because when you think about the United States acting to promote the development of market rate housing, that's free market housing, so, you know, without regulation or anything like that, how would the United States go about actively promoting that? But when you remove the governmental aspect from that, that means that it becomes more of a should and should not resolution, and it kind of eliminates any of the technicalities as far as legislation goes that anyone could really harp on to try to tear the round in a direction where it shouldn't go.
Well, we'll get into here in a little bit, there's still lots and lots of specific details we need to be familiar with. Here, though, I think I agree with you that there's less of an actor here than there normally is. But even with, we do still have a subject, and that's, of course, the United States.
Right.
But even though we're not here talking about our typical subject of the United States federal government, we are dealing with a broad United States, which leaves us lots of room. This could refer to a promotion on a national level. It could be on a state level, a local level. We could be dealing with something as small as homeowners associations.
Yeah. I don't think anyone's going to want to go as far as the national level on this, because once you make a universal thing, I mean, all cities are different, you know what I mean? Like, you've got San Francisco and Charlotte, North Carolina are absolutely nothing like each other. So would a universal policy even be feasible for all these areas? That I wouldn't go to define it as a national thing if I were on any team.
No, and certainly the status quo has that looking very different. I mean, even just in terms of rent regulations, we've got various different situations across the United States with 29 states that have forbidden rent control, but you've also got some areas like New York and California that let rent control be settled even as locally as particular areas of their cities.
Yeah, I think so. Another thing that leapt out at me is development. So just to read, I'm going to read the resolution one more time, because as my awesome and amazing mother told me when she listened to one of our previous What's the Res episodes, is that I should read the resolution. I should read it slow so that everyone can understand, and we're going to pick it apart, you know, incrementally.
It's probably good feedback.
As debaters, we go through this really fast. I feel like we should slow down a little bit. So I'm just going to go through it one more time. The resolution is: the United States should promote the development of market rate housing in urban neighborhoods. So now we're on the word develop. And what do you think of the word develop? How would one go about promoting the development of something, or rather not promoting the development of something else?
Well, I would look at this and think development is a typical term used to refer to the beginning of a new housing development. So we're talking particularly about constructing a neighborhood of houses or perhaps an apartment building. But this is literally taking a piece of ground and turning into livable area for human beings.
Right.
And then that's probably, I suspect, going to go in one of two purposes. Either that development is intended to be rented out to different people, or it's intended to be built and inspected and then sold as soon as possible so the developer can make a profit on his construction.
Right. I think we could both agree that some degree of government is an actor in this, right? We could start off with that.
I think so. And yeah. Part of that has a lot to do with the way that really housing policy affects the structure of a city itself.
Right.
That the housing policy is going to determine a lot of other factors. How many schools are going to be nearby, what the composition of those schools is going to be, the economic level of inhabitants of a neighborhood or a sector of a city. All of that is really going to be made possible through the structure created by the housing policy.
Okay.
So at the very least, we're talking about city ordinances, possibly even state-level guidance as to what kind of economic diversity should a city be aiming for.
And as far as a city goes, what would you define as an urban neighborhood?
That's really a good question. And I think initially when I read this, I was thinking we're talking probably about city centers. We're talking about downtown areas in large cities. So some cities are so large that really being inside the city and in one of the major known areas would constitute an urban neighborhood. If we're talking about DC, New York City, LA, really that's going to involve any of the known parts of those cities, San Francisco. But if we're looking at that a bit more broadly, that could involve wealthier sections of the city. Here in Raleigh, we've got a clear downtown area, but you've got other areas like North Hills that technically aren't downtown, but they've been built up. You've got lots of specifically intentional urban living where people don't really need to drive around as much. You've got a grocery store, you've got apartment buildings, and you've also got different shopping, all within walking distance, which is going to make that, I think, qualify as an urban neighborhood.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I think that, yeah, those areas would definitely be considered cities. I think if you tried to limit the resolution, or any debater out there tried to limit the resolution to purely like New York, San Francisco, I mean, it'd be kind of crazy.
Oh, because really the word urban itself, it comes from the Latin, the urbis, that we're talking about the city. So really, where this resolution is going to have something to do with urban planning and something to do with really each city deciding what should it look like. And we have skipped over one important term. Ethan, help us with what market rate housing refers to. Okay. I'll jump in when you're done.
All right. Market rate housing is charging what the market will bear. So this is like not fixing prices or not fixing rent. This is more of the, I think we'll bring it up later, the laissez-faire approach, where the government, this was something that kind of caught my attention earlier, is where, and this was like the most confusing thing about the resolution for me. It says the United States should promote the development of market rate housing. My mind immediately went to, well, a government is the actor. How would that government go about promoting something that it suggested it should step away from? You know what I mean? Because as far as market, letting the free market reign and the free market go and do its thing, that means the government has to take itself away from a certain situation. So the United States actor has to actually remove itself in a negative action in order for any kind of prosperity to happen.
Oh, so instead of maybe a more typical position where we might be encouraging some new legislation, the affirmative position or the pro side on a public forum debate is really going to be advocating less government intervention in the free market.
Right, yeah. So as far as market rate housing goes, that would be, like I said earlier, charging what the market will bear, not fixing prices, not fixing rent, let the landlords decide what's going on. And that would also play into who gets to live in a city, and is it the government's responsibility to help people live wherever they want to, and is that economically feasible?
Those are big questions, and depending on where in the country we're talking about, we might have wildly different numbers for that. I mean, if you're talking about living in San Francisco, you could be paying anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000 a month in rent.
Wow.
Depending on your neighborhood in Manhattan, you could be looking at a similar ratio, though, as we'll see in a few minutes. There are some other variables in play, because both of those cities have rent stabilization policies that affect just how much can be charged,
right,
and so on. But if you're here in Raleigh, you could have, if you're out in kind of some of the suburban cities around Raleigh, your rent could be looking at anywhere from $800 to $1,500 a month for a 1,000 square foot apartment.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. Like, who doesn't want to live in a city? Like, I know there's people who prefer the country life and living in a larger plot of land, but there's reasons for wanting to live in the city. It's pretty much the heartbeat of society. There's lots of things going on. You'd probably be closer to work. Like, I mean, who doesn't want to live in a city? I want to live in a city. I don't know about you. It looks like Noah wants to live in a city. He's just sitting here smiling at the thought of a city. So, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, and I've always been one of those people that doesn't really like big cities. I get nervous when I'm driving and the traffic picks up too badly. That's just not my favorite part of life. I hate driving through DC or going through Atlanta. It just seems like the worst way to live to me. My brother, Chris, loves the city. He spent 2 years living in Seattle, and he just absolutely loves that whole idea of being in a metropolis that is literally the melting pot center of the world. My youngest brother, Samuel, about every 3 to 4 weeks, he manages just to take a weekend and go be in New York City.
Wow.
He just loves New York City. He'll take the midnight bus, and he'll get there at 8 a.m., and he'll spend... He usually won't, sometimes he'll get an Airbnb, or he'll just literally spend the whole day there and then take a midnight bus back home and just spend the day in the city. There's something about these cities that people enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, this resolution is crazy, because like when I first looked at it, I'm like, really? Market rate housing, free market, government regulation, it seems so simple. But like when you really think about it, I think there's a little bit of a philosophical element, because like I said, or like we said actually in earlier episodes of What's the Res, these have a real world application. This is a real problem or issue that people are dealing with. So how does philosophy play into that? What are the obligations of government to its people?
Well, those are some huge questions, and they're not questions we're going to be able to in any way definitively answer. But I thought of two quotes that I thought might help us with that. One of those comes from ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle. In his book, The Politics, he said, "Man is by nature a creature designed to live in political community."
What could Aristotle possibly know about cities?
Oh my goodness. Well, see, Aristotle lived in Athens, and in his day, Athens was the global city of his day. It was the center of intellectual activity, and things were going well in Athens. It was also the cultural center of the Greek world. It's where drama was born. But what Aristotle's really getting at there is that as human beings, we're not solitary creatures. Instead, we're born in families. Our families, he argued, are organized in tribes, and those tribes eventually gather together in these political units that we call cities. And it's in cities, Aristotle's one of the first ones to argue that it's in cities that you start seeing all kinds of new economic possibilities.
Right.
Division of labor can happen in a city in a way it can't happen on a farm.
Right. Okay.
But the real question becomes, and I think it's the big question behind this debate, is does everyone have the right to live in a particular city?
And does everyone have the right to have that right protected and facilitated and enforced by the government?
Sure. One piece that may also help is It's a line I ran into. I'm reading this week a book called On Grammatology by a French philosopher named Jacques Derrida. And there was a line in the introduction there that struck me as interesting, where the translator wrote, "Structuralism is an attempt to isolate the general structure of human activity. A structure is a unit composed of a few elements that are invariably found in the same relationship with the activity being described." And in that sense, I think that we could take this debate about housing policy and how should a city or a state or a region govern its housing policy really as the internal structure of the area where people are living. Because how much a house costs determines who is going to live there, and then it's going to determine what businesses are willing to situate themselves there. And of course, as where people live determines so many other things about their lives.
So the surrounding area is something to worry about, right?
Very much so. I mean, if there are no grocery stores, that's going to make it difficult for people to live there. If there are no schools, people aren't going to be interested in being there. But if there are neighborhoods, there are people, the people there are going to create the economic activity that is going to drive the city either positively or negatively.
Okay.
So how people buy their houses or rent their living space really determines the rest of the city. So at stake in this debate is not just whether or not San Francisco should manage their rent in a certain direction, but really the political and the human question, how should we live together?
And this is great because you yourself are a homeowner. You've been through the entire process of looking for houses, what's around the houses, and trying to find that sweet medium of where, in your situation, is the best option to put your investment in a house. So how do you think being a homeowner and having been through the entire process of searching for a home and the surrounding area, how does that play into this resolution? What insight can you give high schoolers in debate as to what the housing market looks like from an insider perspective?
Well, certainly that part of that has everything to do with just with reality of where people are in their economic situations. And that honestly what we found was that we could not afford what we were initially looking for and hoping to do. So my wife and I are both full-time teachers. We've got a dual income situation. We don't have any kids yet. And so we had the possibility of looking for a house. The bank was certainly willing to lend us a large amount of money, but then we started looking at what was available. And what we found was that the closer we got to the center of Raleigh, the higher prices rose.
Right.
And that really we were faced with a choice. We could either buy a large house in moving towards Raleigh, and in which case we'd have a really large house payment, or we could go further out. And that the further out from the city center we went, the more house and more land we could afford. And so that really we ended up settling not in Raleigh, but actually in Wendell, hoping that over the next decade or so, Wendell grows and thrives and our home value goes up.
And you're happy with this decision. It's okay to move out. It's okay to not live in the city.
Very much so. One of the other things that we found, and I didn't really know a whole lot about until we were actively looking for a house, was that the way the starter house situation works. Because I wondered how some people who were a few years ahead of us, how did they manage? I knew, okay, you don't make that much money. How are you in this house?
Right.
Well, it turns out that the way some people will do that is they will buy a cheap house that's maybe not in the best of locations, and that's going to be a starter house. It's usually going to be somewhere between $150,000 to $250,000 on an East Coast market. But then they will fix up that house, and they'll sell that house, and then they'll use the profits as they've improved their house, and over time the value of the original house went up. They use those profits to then move to another house. So maybe they move from a house that's valued at $160,000 to one that's valued at $220,000. And maybe they've got an extra 800 square feet as they move to a larger house. And they get to that area that they want. And this really is the way that buying and selling houses becomes a profitable investment for people over time. You improve the house you're in, and you move up over time.
So it's a progressive kind of idea.
It is. And I have other friends who have very high-paying jobs, and they can afford to go immediately to that other house. But for most people, really, that's the route that they take. And that starter home, if that starter home doesn't exist, then really there's a hole in the economy, which is where I think that's going to tie all this back to the resolution.
Right.
Because for market rate housing to exist, you've got to also have those starter homes as part of the equation.
Right. So should the starter homes be right in the heart of the city, or should the starter homes naturally be outside of cities? You progress further inward, I think, is probably where this round will kind of get into.
That's certainly a possibility. But I'm sure we may come up to some other things as we go around. But now there's one thing we also probably ought to also keep in mind is that there are currently there are lots of inner city revitalization projects happening in cities all around the country. And one of the big fears that this is probably going to come up in this kind of round is a concept called gentrification.
Okay.
Ethan, have you run into the idea of gentrification?
I have not.
So here's the kind of scenario that could happen. And for people who love a particular city, they find the idea of gentrification really horrifying. Where maybe you have a city that is hundreds of years old. So say maybe New York City, or maybe more locally, certain parts of Durham. I don't know if Durham's that old, but it's a pretty old city in terms of the East Coast. But and you may have sections of Durham that are more historic in nature. But what can often happen as inner city revitalization occurs is that big companies will purchase sections of land, and then suddenly where there used to be a historic building, now there's a Publix or
right.
a McDonald's really nice, brand new, shiny plexiglass apartment building that now is upscale and modern just like every other city in the country.
Oh, I don't know how I feel about that, or how the public would feel about that, tearing down historical sites. But eventually, like, every site becomes historical. So what do you tear down and what do you not? Something that has, like, sentimental value, I guess, to the surrounding area, to the people there. But that's very subjective, you know.
It can be, and it's something where local communities have to really kind of figure out, do we want the higher economic activity that tends to come with newer businesses, or are we going to say in our housing policy and our development policy that no, we're actually not interested in that business coming and building there? This was actually, to bring in one of your favorite politicians, this was some of the reasoning behind Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's
yes.
arguments about the Amazon headquarters in New York City from last week. Did you follow that story?
Team AOC all the way. yes, I did. I did follow that story. And unfortunately, I think that our favorite congresswoman's logic was a little bit flawed in that situation, and it ended up costing New York City a lot of money and a lot of jobs.
I think the numbers I saw on that were something like $12 billion in economic activity.
And 25,000 jobs or something crazy like that.
And I think $3 billion in tax revenue for the city of New York.
Yep.
But the fear there was that Amazon would come in and build everything new, and that was going to change the city. And it ties to people's fear of change and their love of their home.
Right. And I think that even aside from all of these historical buildings and all of the benefits that you can see in the city, I think those can kind of be categorized into a couple of different things that people really seek and people really want. And of course, there's exceptions to this idea where some people want to live further out, or maybe the starter homes would naturally in a free market situation be further out. But I think to sum it up a little bit, people want to live in the city because it's the heartbeat of society. It's right in the middle of the melting pot, as you said earlier. There's usually companies located nearby, which can be good for less driving, which is the third one, you know, to get to work.
Mm-hmm.
If you work
mm-hmm.
in the city, which again, not everyone works in the city, but a lot of people do at the
sure.
same time. And the idea of a city as community. I think those would be a good four ways to sum up.
Yeah. Well, let's shift that then to really kind of the big question. Should everyone have the ability to live in the center of the city? And if so, how do we achieve that goal? Ethan, are there any, what kind of affirmative arguments or pro arguments? I got to keep the public forum
right.
lingo in
pro.
Mind.
Okay. The number one, so pro, get in your mindset, is free market. The free market will solve everything. If you go back to the wording of the resolution, we want the United States to promote market rate housing development. That's right. So the principle of the affirmative is saying that it might be okay that not everyone can live in the city, because the poorest of the poor people, it's kind of like if you had the government subsidize or in any way kind of artificially make it so that these new developments that are more affordable were in the city, it's not, it doesn't work economically, because then you have a really big gap mm-hmm. in between the really rich people living in the luxury apartments, and then you have really affordable housing developments on the lower end. And the affirmative team wants to say that there's a supply and demand curve, and where there's plenty of demand for housing, let the free market rule, let it reign, and landlords will see this opportunity and developers will see the opportunity. They'll build houses, landlords will get a hold of them, and eventually prices will slowly trickle down and work their way down to where people who want to be able to afford a home in the city will be able to do that. And I feel myself leaning, I don't really know where I am on this resolution right now. It's a little bit confusing, I'm not going to lie. Real estate isn't really my thing, but I think that affordable is a really hard term to grasp in this round, because I do believe in the free market, and I think that once you have more and more housing being built, again, think of sprawl. This gets further and further away from the heart right. of the city. So how much of a city really is it if you're building all these new developments in a free market system? But how affordable can you get? Because really, really, really rich people live in the city. So competition can drive these costs down a good amount, but is it an amount to where these people who want the affordable homes, can they afford that? Or does it just drive it down to where the middle class is? Like, who deserves what home and where should that home be?
Well, those are important questions that as folks are writing their cases, their arguments are going to be proposing answers to. And one thing we should probably keep in mind is that affordable is a very relative term.
Right.
And there is no absolute definition that's freed from connections. Affordable is really it's indexed to the affluence of the city. So if you're talking about somewhere like the San Francisco Bay Area or Silicon Valley, where you have software engineers and entrepreneurs who are cranking out the next great idea, and you've got venture capitalists kind of floating around almost in the air, and millions of dollars seemingly happens, million-dollar deals are happening all the time, affordable might mean a $20 Big Mac or a $100,000 per year rent.
Yeah, and keep in mind, affirmative team, that you do need some sort of plan, and maybe not too specific, but I think that, Josh, we talked about a little bit earlier, that the affirmative has to have some way to articulate how they're going to do this, especially right. since there's no actor named in the resolution. But I think that the most important thing is to make the negative team realize that it's okay if it takes a while, because the free market system tends to drive things down pretty fast. But in order to get to pure affordability, where there's this perfect pyramid of affordable to middle class to like upper middle, all the way up to the upper class luxury apartments, that can't happen overnight. But the government developing buildings, you know, on the spot, affordable buildings just appear there, that can happen a little bit faster. I think that would happen faster for the negative side of things.
Well, certainly Neg could certainly make that argument. And there's plenty of, I've run into plenty of debaters who have a firm confidence in government efficiency. I've not run into as much evidence for that firm confidence in government efficiency.
I ran into a really decent piece of evidence that wasn't really like a case study or anything, mm-hmm. but it was a really good logical way of thinking about it that I think the negative team could safely use in a round.
How so? What evidence did you run into?
I ran into something where the affirmative is arguing for a trickle-down system where the free market will want to meet supply, more people will come in and build more houses, and then eventually you'll get a more even competitive thing where there's the exclusive apartments, which are more expensive, and then eventually just climb your way down to the ones that are affordable and everyone can eventually live in the city. I don't see evidence of where that's happened, because if I go to New York City, I know I'm not going to find an apartment that I can afford. I don't even have a job, you know what I mean? So maybe not
sure.
But as a high schooler, but someone who's making money. But the negative team could argue, or sorry, the con team, I guess I should say, that what if there's a trickle-up theory? I heard this thing about the trickle-up theory where imagine there's a low-income individual living in a medium-income apartment. So not that they can't afford it, but almost all of their money is going into every month's rent in the middle of the city because there's no affordable places where they could spend less of their money on rent and more of their money within the economy.
Mm-hmm.
So if there were affordable developments built by the government to help make this process go faster and keep these people in the city, then those people who have lower income could move from their very stressful situation in a very expensive apartment down to a lower income spot, which frees up the areas in those medium spots. And once those are freed up, then more people who fit that demographic can move in there, and then everybody's able to live in the city a little bit faster in the free market system.
So in both of those scenarios that you just proposed, increasing the supply was pretty key.
Increasing the supply is key. Yeah, it's basically how you do it. Is the government going to increase supply, and are we going to have fixed rates so that these people have to live here or can move here, or are we going to let the free market reign and see what happens?
Well, and it's fascinating. There are plenty of places in the country, usually in these metropolitan areas, where there simply is not enough supply for the people. I've been fascinated to watch some of the stories coming out of California. San Jose State University currently has a big problem with this because they have several thousand homeless students. Students are enrolled as full-time college students, but they can't afford room and board at San Jose State, and they also can't afford to rent local apartments. Wow. So students are sleeping on park benches in the library. It's a growing problem. I think you've hit on one of the pieces there, that on either side, we've got to find a mechanism to increase supply.
Yeah, and those people, maybe the best option for them right now is don't live in the city. If you move out to a different area, or maybe it won't be as nice in the beginning, but that's the point. It's a starter home or even a starter apartment where you could pay rent for a while, get yourself a secure job, earn the money that you need to progressively, physically move closer and closer into the city until you've earned your spot there. It seems like a more affirmative approach, but the negative would say everyone has the right to live in the city if they want to. We need the government to step in and make this happen.
I remember three years ago, an economist named Tyler Cowen came to Thales as part of our Luddy lecture series.
Yeah, I remember.
He gave a speech on his book that had just come out. His book's called Average is Over. And one of the key arguments that he presents in that book is that the vast majority of Americans who are sitting comfortably in the middle class space that in his that he thinks is swiftly disappearing, one of the reasons that they're running out of economic options is because they're not willing to move.
So no change.
So for example, if you have city A that is economically stagnant, but you're born in city A, but city B is economically flourishing. Well, Cowen's argument is that really you should move to the place where things are happening and where opportunity exists. And I think that fits pretty well with the affirmative's plan, or at least not so much a plan, because we've got to keep in mind it's public forum and
not
you can't
policy.
Do a full plan rather than a policy case. But at least affirmative's arguments should keep in mind that no one has to live in a particular city that has a housing crisis. There are plenty of places in the United States that have more depressed housing markets where property values are really low. So maybe if you have the right kind of work, you can shift to a different location where you can afford to purchase property and so on. But there's other opportunities. But we've been focusing on AF. Maybe we should shift gears to NEG. And Ethan, you were arguing for more of a laissez-faire, kind of hands-free on the government side. How does NEG handle the economics of the con position?
Oh, boy. Okay, so switching mindsets really quick. The negative team has to think about the government, and the government absolutely has to come in because philosophically there's this right that everybody should be able to live in the city should they want to, and they should be given that option. Remember, the affirmative mindset is talking about a progressive movement inwards, perhaps, is one approach, because that's not a required approach, but I feel like that's where we've gone with the affirmative mindset.
Mm-hmm.
But the negative team says the government has to step in, so how would the government step in is the question. The government comes in, and it pays developers to build housing, but then the government says, okay, we're going to fix rates on this housing. So this is the fixed rate for rent, and landlords don't have the freedom to move this rent up or down based on what the market demands, which right now the demand is very high because everyone wants houses, which is part of the problem. So rents would be stuck at a fixed rate, and landlords couldn't charge people more to live there, which means that these houses would be more affordable. So a different demographic of people as far as finances go would be able to move into the city and live in these areas, but the landlords wouldn't be able to make as much money off of it, is the affirmative response to that, I would say. But focusing on the negative, this is better because it guarantees everyone the opportunity to live in the city who has this much money. So we bring that amount down that you need to live in the city. And everyone has the rights to these benefits that that entails.
So we're really, we can still increase supply of housing, but now we're gonna have some mechanism of fixing the rate at which that housing is available at something that the local government defines as accessible to the people in general.
Yeah, con. Wow,
I'm having trouble doing this the whole episode. I'm sure our audience will be okay. Yeah. Keep going.
Okay, so con side. Your best argument is guaranteed affordability. The free market cannot guarantee that everybody has the right to live in the city or in you, that the free market can give everybody the opportunity that they deserve. Con, you should harp on the fact that if the government fixes these rates, these houses are there, this is how much you pay for it, and the government says so. And it's guaranteed. It's right there.
So one of the other pieces on con would be to look at the fact that people who are currently living in these neighborhoods, in these cities, are literally, in a way, they're being priced out of their own neighborhoods.
Right. So it's like they have a right to this neighborhood.
Right. It's as if, and there's a couple different ways that happens. I was talking with a friend last night who's thinking about selling his townhouse. And he'd make a decent amount of money based on the price of where he purchased his townhouse. The problem is he can't afford to buy anything bigger than his current townhouse in the same area, because the way the market has moved and the market has risen, the value of everything around him has gone up. He can't afford to be mobile in that. So if he's going to move up in terms of the kind of house he's in, he's got to go away from the city.
He has to go back in order to go forwards.
Exactly. So really, this could be a great argument on con to look at how the market does not favor the people who have lived in that city and have really contributed perhaps to the community of that city over time.
See, if this friend seemed to know a lot about economics, I'm sure he would be able to maneuver his way around the situation pretty well, don't you think?
Hopefully. And maybe we'll get him on our next Good Economics episode.
Yeah, I have a feeling he knows a lot about what he's doing.
Now, one other example I was looking at of this earlier today is the concept of rent stabilization that is practiced a lot in New York City. And we'll put a link in the show notes. The National Association of Realtors published a white paper on looking at the kind of mechanisms for price controls on property going throughout the United States. And they've got a great graphic describing how does rent stabilization work in New York City. And the way this works is if you live in an apartment building in New York City that's of a certain age, building was built before a certain date in the 1970s, well, in that case, your rent is stabilized at a certain point. It cannot change until you either move out or you die. In which case, so theoretically, you could have an individual who, let's say, moves into a building in 1979. That is 40 years ago. And their rent was, let's just come up with an arbitrary number of, say, $150 a month in 1979. Well, today, that person could theoretically still be alive 40 years later and still be paying roughly that same amount of money.
Is that adjusted for inflation?
Not that I'm aware of.
What city is
this? This is New York City.
You're telling me that people are paying rent in the heart of New York City at $150 a month?
That, I don't know. I don't know that's that specific example. I'm making that up as a hypothetical example.
I was about to say what?
No, but see, here's the trick, Ethan. You can't move to New York City and get that rate because... Let's say that it's the guy who has that scenario and he passes away. Well, as soon as he's dead, the landlord can put that apartment out at market rate. Now suddenly this apartment that the landlord honestly was probably taking a loss on.
Right.
But now he can put that out there at, say, let's say a hypothetical number of $3,500 a month for this apartment. But that's another mechanism that the negative could look, or the con side could look at and say, well, one way that this could happen is through rent stabilization policies that really kind of effectively lock people in at the current rate that they're at.
Yeah, if I were moving to New York City, I would really prefer that $150 a month, especially if that weren't adjusted for inflation, I was still paying that amount. But if I'm con, I'm coming in saying, I have the right to live here, make it happen.
And that really is, those are some of the ways. Now, we've mentioned a couple of case studies in here, but really, New York City and San Francisco are probably two of the best cities for debaters to focus on for how exactly does this scenario work when you have these kind of fixed rate placed put in place for housing options.
Yeah, okay. You know what else?
What else?
This coffee is really good.
Is it?
Oh, yeah, yeah, it's really good.
Ah,
I guess we could talk about San Francisco now, but I just thought I should say that.
Well, that coffee does not, I don't think that comes from San Francisco. That's 8 o'clock coffee. It's good stuff.
Yep, okay, let's move on.
Yep. So, but one of the things that we should note about San Francisco is that they have a pretty unique situation because of the geography of the city. San Francisco is on a peninsula, and it's got 49 square miles of habitable space.
That's it.
So you have a limited amount of space, but that is one of the hottest places people want to live right now. So to apply our basic economics, supply is limited, but demand is really high. So you've got a position for a great rising cost in the city.
Right. And according to the pro side of the resolution, this is okay. Like, you have a limited amount of space, a very specific amount of people can live here. That has to naturally be a selective thing of who can live here. And if you earn your way up to the top and you choose to live in the city and you earn enough money for it, then you can live there. But the negative team is saying that everybody has the right to live there, regardless mm-hmm. of the fact that there's limited supply, which I really think could strangle the economy in some sort of way, make it really stagnant. If we have poorer people moving into affordable housing, can they contribute as much as those, you know, extremely rich business owners, venture capitalists, investors, all these people can contribute to the economy in that area?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. I mean, that too is going to get to the question of how selective do cities want to be in terms of their policies?
And what right do they have to be selective? Like, do cities have the right to say, we want the richest people here so that we can grow the most? Does the city have the right to make the best selective decisions possible for its own growth?
Well, and then too, we've also got the question of what are we defining as best? Is this I think there's not to go too heavily down this road, but I think there's an easy argument for Khan to make that in certain cities, and Khan would need to have the specific evidence to back this up, but I think the argument is there. In certain cities, what you have going on is that as the market is creating a Marxist scenario whereby you have the wealthy are able to displace the poor in that city over time.
Is that a pro argument, you mean?
I think that's a con argument. If you view that as discrimination against those who are economically middle and lower class.
Right, I get it.
This is
now
the upper class using their financial clout to really push people out of a city where they have been for perhaps decades.
Their financial what?
To their financial clout, their power, their amount of money.
Oh, okay. All right.
Okay.
I got it. Yeah. All right. Yeah, I see the argument now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so we're probably getting towards the end of our time.
Oh, yeah.
Ethan, I know this is a public forum debate. It's not Lincoln Douglas. But are there any kind of philosophical frameworks or paradigms that debaters ought to keep in mind as they're picking their arguments and searching for evidence?
Of course. LD debate is everywhere. And any public forum debater that tries to deny that, they simply can't make that argument. Keep in mind, debaters, that regardless of how economic and how set and how factual every resolution is, there are people behind it. There are humans behind the resolution. Therefore, there's some kind of philosophical thought that can cater to that. There's always people that will be affected by this. So going into that, the pro side has to focus on the free market system, market rate housing, and the free market will be able to cater to what is right, maybe not necessarily for all and encompass every single human being in an ideal situation, but what's pragmatic. And that's having the free market in place, and the city has the right to be selective about who can live there based on free market rates of what the housing are. And that's okay, because the city is developed and it has the right to grow itself to its maximum potential. Then the con side has to come in, and it's playing the card as far as focusing on the people who want to live in the city and saying that those people have the right to live in the city more than the city has the right to kick them out.
And that really those people are almost being discriminated against by what Adam Smith called the invisible hand of the
right.
free market.
Yeah, and those people have the right to have the government come in and fix that situation through fixed rates such as on things such as rent, so that everybody can live in the city. But how do you do that if there's a limited amount of space? I guess is the question the affirmative could ask back. But yeah, there's LD implications everywhere. Should we have a free market that's selective, or should we have the right for everyone to live in the city if they want to? And how would that play out as far as impacts go? Because public forum, if I'm not mistaken, should be having impacts in their cases as well.
Should. Yeah. And just as one more plug for the National Realtors Association white paper, it does list 10 affirmative impacts and 12 negative impacts to having rent, having price controls. So I found that a helpful resource to kind of look through as we were thinking about this today. Now, one other thing as we wrap up, it may be helpful for folks to keep in mind that housing costs determine a lot of other factors that it's worth thinking about.
Right.
The housing in an area affects the schools. It affects local businesses. It affects what places of worship are put in place. And if you have low-cost housing or government-subsidized housing, it is really difficult to get businesses to come into those areas, because those subsidized housing projects are often associated, rightly or wrongly, with higher levels of drug use and criminal activity.
Right. That was a pretty far stretch for like the end of the podcast, for sure, because think about it. Like, what are the implications of what types of people are living in the city? You know what I mean? It's a question that at least one of the teams has to ask the other team. Mm-hmm. And that kind of plays into the city's whole right of being selective as to who lives there, what kind of contribution comes from different areas, and all that sort of thing. And that, I think that is the safest place to attach this to the LD thought process of where this resolution goes, because I promise you, it's there.
Well, certainly, hopefully, as people are preparing for this debate, they'll manage to both have the philosophy part in the back of their minds, but also use that then to shape their specific arguments so that they're prepared well for the pro and con side this debate.
Do you have any last recommenders for our listeners?
No. I'm going to try. I think I probably had one or two verbal fumbles on this episode too, but hopefully no more chicken tenders that I'm serving up on our podcast.
You know what I like? I like financial clout. What a great phrase. I think that's a perfect way to describe it.
Oh my, financial power, lots of it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us today on What's the Res, an ongoing conversation about the current resolutions in the world of high school debate. Join us next time for a conversation about definitions and the role they play in debate. Ethan, if any of our listeners want to get in touch with us, how can they do that?
That's right. You can find us on Instagram at whatstheres_. Or if you want to email us, you can email us at whatstheres@gmail.com. That's whatstheres @gmail.com. And we would love to take any of your questions and respond to the best of our ability.
Join us next time for more What's the Res. It's the